the cure for cancer was already there. It was on some kid who never got out of high school, who never had an opportunity to go to Johns Hopkins and get into development. It was some young lady who was denied and told, don't go into science, that's not for you. It is in your best interest to do it. Exercise your right of self-determination. And as people are making demands on you, you can make demands on the skill set of people that you're bringing in, because people just want the opportunity. And you'll be surprised at the level of intelligence, of great work ethic, of productivity that will be brought to your operation because of inclusion.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening in this week to Dwayne Morris, D&I 360 with Joe West. I am Yamika Anderson Howard, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Manager at the firm. Today, it is with pleasure to have joining us in honor of Juneteenth, actor, activist, and entrepreneur Wendell Pierce, as he discusses issues of concern to communities of color and his recent entry into media ownership.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. I'm very, very thrilled to be able to have this conversation with my friend Wendell Pierce, who is, as most of you know, one of the most acclaimed and talented actors working today. But he also is a very forceful voice for equity out there in the ecosystem. He's also an accomplished entrepreneur and just an all-around fantastic guy. So, Wendell.
Thank you very much, Joe. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me. And hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
So, as I mentioned, Wendell, and I will tell you that we have a very broad audience. All of the Dwayne Morris family has been invited, 900 plus lawyers and all of our staff, family members, friends, but a large number of our clients as well. And I will say to you that most people do know of your work as an actor, but a lot of people perhaps aren't as familiar with other aspects of your work. And I want to kind of get into that a little bit. In 2013, Fast Company magazine named you one of the 100 most creative people in business. So let's talk first a little bit about your entrepreneurship and the work you've done in that area.
Well, thank you, Joe. You know, it was a matter of circumstance that got me involved. I've always been taught, you know, growing up, no matter what you do, exercise your right of self-determination. And that's something that I preach in my companies, I preach in my meetings, civically, as I'm involved in my community. But it was the circumstance that brought me to becoming more of an entrepreneur. And that was Katrina. I'm from New Orleans. The city was destroyed. I knew the minute it happened, I was there, that it was going to be those people that took the initiative to bring the city back. And that was going to be important, that we shouldn't wait on anyone else. We'd look for our allies to help us. But that was the thing that got me involved. And I'm from a very historic neighborhood, Pontchartrain Park. It was one of the first neighborhoods in post-World War II in segregated New Orleans where African-Americans could purchase a home. It was like Levittown, you know, that was all of the new suburbia of the 1950s that was happening all over the United States. And the ugliness of segregation denied access to just green space for Black people. You weren't allowed as a Black person to go into a park in New Orleans except for one day, Wednesday, Negro Day. And with the advocacy of A.P. Turow, a wonderful lawyer, civil rights lawyer in New Orleans, his advocacy forced the government to adapt itself to something that I still thought was ugly, but we made it beautiful, separate but equal. And this one subdivision was coming up, and they made a separate section for those lawyers, doctors, GIs like my father coming back from World War II, postal workers, housekeepers. to actually purchase homes. And it was a 1,000-home community built around a golf course designed by Joseph Bartholomew, African-American golf designer, landscape architect, who designed most of the courses in New Orleans but couldn't play on them because he was Black. Which is that sort of duality is the thing that we always must remember about America. And so he created a course in Pontchartrain Park. I say all of that as a prelude to understanding how precious the neighborhood was. Our first Black mayor came out of it, Dutch Morial, his son, who's national president of the Urban League, Mark Morial, and was a mayor himself. Our first Black DA, Terrence Blanchard, who is an award-winning jazz trumpeter and composer, the first Black composer of an opera at the Metropolitan Opera that premiered this fall, Fire Shut Up in My Bones. The first time in 145 years at the Metropolitan Opera. So that was an incubator of Black talent and Black excellence. And it was expected of us to do well when we're coming from the community. What Baldwin Hills was to Los Angeles, what Sweet Auburn was to Atlanta, it was a real incubator of talent, totally destroyed in Katrina. And so there was this Moses generation that gave us a legacy of activism and excellence. And they passed the baton to us, a Joshua generation. And I put out a call saying, we can't let Pontchartrain Park or our community or our city for that fact, go down and be destroyed and maybe never come back. So I put out a call to action and we put together our own community development corp, Pontchartrain Park Community Development Corp. And we started to rebuild our community house by house, block by block, and rebuilt 40 houses in our community, solar and geothermal, looking to the future because we're saying, hey, I can't ask you to come back to a disaster zone if I don't give you some upgrades. So a quarter of the houses had those green energy elements. And so that was the thing that spurred me into doing more as an entrepreneur. And while I was having a wonderful career as an actor, I still am, I realized that there was opportunity there. And so I began my career as an entrepreneur.
It was almost the accidental entrepreneur, but you did it at the confluence of need and creativity. And I think you continue that work in addressing something that is common in a lot of urban areas, and that's food deserts.
Yes. What happened was as we were rebuilding the homes, I realized our commercial districts weren't coming back also. And one of the first things I did that actually a lot of people don't know is we had a mall that was at the nexus and kind of like the anchor for our community and totally destroyed by the flood. And the owners were selling it. It appraised for $5 million. And they were selling it for $4 million. And I remember advocating to the Redevelopment Authority of New Orleans, saying, bring the mall back, take some of the money and put into the mall, because if I'm building houses to bring people back, they're going to need services. They're going to need the commercial sector to come back as well. And they kept saying, well, we're not in the business of bringing back commercial districts. And I'm like, yes, you are. You're in redevelopment. Right. And Mr. Pierce, you're not going to be the one. I don't want you to think that, you're going to get the mall. I said, no, I'm not going to jail for anyone. I'm going to answer an RFP like anyone else. Like my community wants to see the stores and we're going to the stores in it. And we're going to actively go out and pursue those retailers that we would like to bring in. And they still were against it. And I just said, listen, it will be the day you sign on the dotted line, you're up $1 million. It appraises $1 million. And it took me forever to convince the city of New Orleans to see that. And finally they did. And actually our commercial sector came back. Although we didn't win the RFP, the community didn't. It was bringing back the commercial sector as well. In that process, I realized how much more needed to be done. And as you said, necessity is the birth of invention. And so I saw that so many food deserts were in New Orleans. And I decided to bring back a grocery store. Started in the lower Ninth Ward trying to bring back a grocery store there. Many people around the world know of the lower Ninth Ward after Katrina. It hasn't had a grocery store since for 40 years, going on 50 years now, and still doesn't have one. And that's when I opened a store in the community. It is a very difficult business. We have our successes. We have our failures. Our largest store was around for about two years, and we had to downsize to a few convenience stores, and that was Sterling Farms. And Sterling Fresh Foods is the name of the business. That led me to connecting all the activism of the housing and then the food deserts. It made me realize that activism and the blueprint from the 20th century was the fact that you had to have a way to communicate and give the voiceless voice, a platform of activism, a platform that they can impact government to address their grievances and actually spawn what I think is the 21st century social justice movement, which is economic development. And with that in mind, taking the 20th century blueprint of activism and the 21st century aspirations of economic development as social development, as social justice, I bought a 70-year-old Black-owned radio station, Black talk radio station in New Orleans, WBOK 1230 AM, what New Orleans is talking about. It was the place where Black folks in New Orleans in a segregated time could hear, there's a fish fry at the church on Friday, and Dr. King is going to be here on Sunday. The SCLC actually started in New Orleans at Dookie Chase, around the table of the wonderful cuisine and famous soul food restaurant, and with the President Dent over at Dillard University, where Martin Luther King came over there. And so it's really important that legacy is continued on and that platform is there. And I felt it was important to save that station when it was being sold. And I came together with three other partners and we bought WBOK, the only African-American owned radio station and Black talk radio station in New Orleans. So that is my activism and my entrepreneurship all in one.
So there's a few things that you touched upon that I want to dig into a little bit. I'm going to get back to WBOK and the fact that you are a media owner right now and how significant that is. You talked about the Moses generation, though. I want you to talk a little bit about your father. I remember having a conversation with you many years ago when you talked about your dad and the fact that he fought in World War II. I think his segregated army unit in the Marines fought in the Battle of Saipan, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
He actually earned medals that he was refused. They actually refused him the medals that he earned. And he ended up coming back to a country that he fought for, risked his life for, had comrades die for, and it was still thoroughly segregated. Talk a little bit about that one.
Yeah, my father is emblematic of just generations and generations of African-Americans who love this country, even when this country didn't love them back. And I think that's important to understand, for all of us to understand. And, you know, a celebration like today, Juneteenth, is a celebration for all of us, all communities, all races, all genders, to understand the importance of it, because we are attempting to be that more perfect union. And we must learn from people like my father, 97 years old now, still with us. He fought in the Battle of Saipan with a segregated army unit attached to the 3rd Marines. Combat for him was as he came to the beaches with supplies after the first initial invasion, raining down on them were mortar fire. And so I think of him often as I look at the war happening now in Ukraine, where it's the same sort of war for most of the civilians and the units. So they are being rained down upon with artillery and missiles, cruise missiles and the such. My father fought there and came back home before his papers, and a white female officer, a WAC officer, was discharging him. And he said, listen, my papers are behind me, but I think we received some medals. And she said, yeah, right, you. And he said, yeah, me and my unit. She said, don't believe you, discharge. My mother came to me about in 2010 and said, Wendell, you know your father has been mad about these medals. He was hurt that he didn't receive them. But we got a letter from the Army, and they said that his unit did get these medals, and it details all of them. And I want you to get your father his medals. I reached out to the World War II Museum, and I asked my mother, give me the letter. Let me see it so I can reference it. And she brings me this yellowed piece of paper from January 1945 that she had held on to all of that time to get her beloved husband of 60 years his medals. And now here's the most important part. I reached out to the World War II Museum and our senator at the time, Mary Landrieu, and they said, absolutely, Wendell, not only are we going to get your father his medals, but we're going to have a ceremony for him in his honor at the World War II Museum. My brother went to West Point, so I told him, you have to be there. And as he pinned your lieutenant bars on you, you're going to pin your father. So it was very emotional for us.
Wow.
Pinned my father with those medals. I thought he didn't want to speak. They honored him again at a gala, and he said, can I speak? And I said, yes. He got up there and he said, you know, I was mad for a long time about these medals, and I've seen so much. He said, but, you know, this country has come so far because people have worked so hard, and so many have given so much. And we have to remember the sacrifices made, especially by those who, you know, the benefits of this country haven't been given to. And he was talking about how hurt he was, but how evolved he has become because he hadn't hung on to that anger, and that he got these medals. And in the middle of the speech, he stops and he just says, God bless America. Right. And that's the most important thing, right? That he said, keep the work going on and you will be blessed. And so that was the lesson. I said, I didn't even know my father could speak like that. And someone turned to me and said, where the hell do you think you got it from? Right? So my father is a emblematic of that generation that gave us a blueprint of advocacy. I tell people all the time, in the harshest manner, I say, when you think about this country, you should be thankful. This was said by an activist in 2020 during the Black Lives Matter protest movement. I said, you should be thankful that African Americans want equality and not revenge. You know, that is a harsh thing to say, but it's a hard reminder that, you know, this country should be thankful that there's so many, that so much oppression and systematic oppression and murder and violence towards the community for generations, that we still believe in the values of that, of those documents that declare what our values are or should be. Barbara Jordan said one time, I'll never forget, she said it the best. She said, the Constitution was a good document. With the amendments of the 13th and 14th, it became a great document, right? And so the ability that we have to amend, to find redemption for our evolution as a country is what we celebrate today on June 10th, that we all should celebrate, that this holiday is actually emblematic of what America does. The fact that so many enslaved people did not know they were free until years later, right? That's what happened in Juneteenth. And now we know. We find out. And the reaction isn't destruction, but celebration. So we evolve to say, be thankful that people are vengeful, but actually are asking for equality and making sure that we live up to being that more perfect union.
So one of the commonalities of your discussion about the activism and the entrepreneurship is the extent to which those things inure to the benefit, not just of some, not just to people of color, not just to African Americans, but to the whole. There's a study that I like to cite that Citigroup released, I think it was in September of 2020, that found that in the first 20 years of this century, from 2000 to 2020, because of inequities in our system, the U.S. lost $16 trillion in GDP. $16 trillion in GDP was lost because of inequities in housing, in lack of access to capital for entrepreneurship, medical disparities, educational disparities, income disparities, redlining. And that was startling to me because I think in a good year, we have about 19 to 20 trillion of GDP. 16 trillion lost. That is startling because it illustrates to people how actually focusing on equity and principles of fairness not just benefit disadvantaged communities, but everybody. And that Absolutely. Seems to be a common theme of what you're talking about and what you're trying to do.
Absolutely. I spoke to the Chamber of Commerce one time. And in New Orleans, the birthplace of jazz, there across from the Hyatt Regency Hotel where I was speaking, is the Eagle Saloon in the Oddfellows Hall. It is on the National Register of Historic Places. To this day, it sits delinquent and abandoned in the middle of parking lots. It cannot be torn down because it's on the National Register of Historic Places. But only in an American city like New Orleans would you see the dereliction of something that people, pilgrims from around the world, come to New Orleans to see and hear, which is the American music of jazz. Mm-hmm. Right, one of the great jazz creations. And I told the Chamber of Commerce, I said, be selfish, you're leaving money on the table, you're leaving capital on the table. People come from around the world to see where the music was started. Do you think Vienna would do the same? I can tell you right now, in Vienna, there is a Mozart concert or a concerto being played, a chamber music or orchestra or a singer. Someone is playing Mozart this week and weekend at all times in Vienna. They celebrate and monetize one of the great cultural icons of their city. In New Orleans, we have a saying, we love New Orleans music, but we don't love New Orleans musicians. We have Congo Square that sits with only an occasional festival there where captured Africans created the music of jazz. We don't have a New Orleans Jazz Hall of Fame. We don't have a museum. The museum has just started. Most people in New Orleans don't even know that jazz is the only intangible national park. The art form itself is a national park. Thank God for that designation. But when people come to New Orleans, they're always surprised that the city itself, the community itself, does not celebrate it within the same way. We should have a Royal Albert Hall for jazz.
Yes.
Congo Square should be like every Sunday celebrated. I say all of that is because at that hall, I told them at the Oddfellows Hall, where Buddy Bolden and Kid Ory and King Oliver created the music, Jelly Roll Morton, a little Louis Armstrong, who was working next door at the Karnowski grocery store, would listen in and be influenced, who then went around the world. What was our response to that? Let's destroy the neighborhood where that created this because we feel as though they're inferior, you know, back of town. And these are the only buildings that remain, and they only stand there empty and derelict. So
It's, and most people who know me know that I'm a New Orleanian as well. We have in common, Wendell, the fact that we lost our home in Hurricane Katrina as well. And so I think what you're talking about is emblematic of our unwillingness, not just in that community, but in a lot of communities, to honor and cherish the things that make us fantastic and great.
Yeah, I guess it was a long-winded way of getting to your actual question, which is, it is in the benefit of everyone to tap into the greatest resources that we have, which are our people, our communities. I am a capitalist. I tell people this all the time. I am a true capitalist. I think people practicing or attempting or calling themselves capitalists today are not, because a capitalist wants everyone to get educated. Because the more education, the more ideas, the more ideas, the more competitive and better the ideas, the better the ideas, the more successful you become. And the more successful the ideas, it creates growth. It creates growth. And there's so many people who now subscribe to an idea of capitalism as being finite, without growth. Only my kids should be educated. There's a zero-sum game, right? They confuse competition with eliminating opportunity for others, instead of saying, I want everybody in the game, because then it improves, right? I want more people in school, instead of only my kids go to school, only opportunities for me, get as much of the pie as possible, because it ain't growing. There's not going to be any left. And that is a defeatist attitude. And it also goes against what I think true capitalism can be.
So let me talk about two things. One, you mentioned those imperfect documents that are at the nexus of the foundation of this country. You know, I'm stunned when I see and I hear now so many people take the position that racism played no role in the founding of this country, when those documents you just talked about, you said Barbara Jordan said they were good, but when amended, they were great.
Right.
You know, the foundation of this country, Black folks were considered, and it was codified, 3/5 of a human being. And that was done so that slaveholding states and individuals who owned slaves could actually benefit and profit and have voting power, based upon the notion that Blacks were 3/5 of a human being. But now you see this effort to sort of erase that part of our history. As a learned individual, Wendell, I know you to be learned, and everyone in the audience now realizes that. I'd love your thoughts about that, this sort of trend towards book burning that we see, and just erasure of those unpleasant parts of our history.
Right. I think it's... this is an extension of what I was saying. I found a quote today that really it struck me, because it really spoke to, as I was thinking about what we were going to talk about today, it really struck me as something that's at the heart of what a lot of people who are now in a denial about how this country was created, where they are. And it's a part of that sense of entitlement that they're losing. They feel like they're losing. And so you perpetuate this idea of the great replacement, right? But it says, this is a great quote. Hate is the coward's revenge for ever having been afraid. Hate is the coward's revenge for ever having been afraid. You lash out because you were afraid that you weren't good enough, or you weren't going to be allowed to be continue to be successful, that privilege was the only way that you were going to get there. And that whole idea of erasure of true history and denial of where our country came from is being manipulated by those who just want power. And those that they're manipulating it, and we've seen that throughout the history of the country. We shouldn't be surprised by it. we should be prepared for it. As evil people plot, good people plan, as they said in the civil rights movement. More than ever, we have to realize it's a continuum. We have to get out of the habit of thinking, oh, we've reached this point of evolution, and now we can just sit back on our laurels because we are now evolved, intelligent people. When the truth of the matter is, the barbarians are always at the gate.
So, Wendell, I want to talk about WBOK. As a New Orleanian, I know what a treasure, an absolute treasure, WBOK is to that community. And I know that there's an online presence. Really, it can be a treasure beyond New Orleans. And as a member of the Board of Trustees at Xavier University, I was very pleased to play a small role in BOK getting that affiliation. Talk to people about WBOK, what its programming is, what it means to you to now be among that very rarefied air, that small list of Black media owners in this country, and give people some understanding and an introduction to BOK.
WBOK is a Black talk radio station, 1230 AM. If you go to WBOK1230.com, you can listen to it online all over the world. And it gives voice to the community to voice their concerns and actually speak directly to the leadership in government, because one, we have in the morning, Oliver Thomas, who was actually on, just won his seat on the New Orleans City Council. He has our morning show, and he brings on a lot of the leaders in the community. The leadership in the community, all of our political leaders, understand that this is a place where they are going to be able to speak directly to the people, and the people know that they can speak truth to power. They have that access. We know that this radio station, WBOK, has been around for 70 years and has been reflective of the concerns of the Black community. And it has enabled the Black community to use their voice in a way that they actually can move the needle and have an impact, not only in a political way, but in a cultural way. We celebrate culture. We have a noontime show called The Front Porch, which is literally as if you were walking in a neighborhood and you come upon the front porch and you see your good friends and you sit down for a good chat. It's funny, it's entertaining, and at the same time, we introduce people to some of the cultural events in the city. You know, the music around town is High on the Hog, the book about cuisine and the evolution of cuisine. And the writers, the writers group, Kalamu Yasalam is a great writer in the city that would come on. Thomas Dent, when he was alive, it gives a forum for that. That's very important for me. I have a program called Profiles with Wendell Pierce, where I try to expose people to some of the people I've met and worked with. On that show, I've had Vanessa Williams and Charles Barkley, Wynton Marsalis, Cheryl Eiffel. I've had Anthony Mackie and so many others on there, celebrities, not only of New Orleans, but from around the entertainment world, where I've connected with them. So I give the people, the grassroots listeners of WBOK, an opportunity to voice their concerns and have a voice in New Orleans politically and culturally. And at the same time, expose them to some of the people that in my world travels, I get to meet, and I want them to meet on a personal level. So it's a very unique and legacy station, I like to call it, because I can imagine all the people that have come through and have been on our airways that have spoken to the people directly. And the only thing I wish we had was archives. We don't have the archives from the days back then. They weren't kept. I can only imagine, as I said, you know, I'm sure Dr. King was on here. Avery Alexander was on this. Aretha Castle Haley, who's one of our great civil rights leaders in New Orleans, came on the station. For 70 years, we have been the voice of the community, and I'm so proud and happy to make sure that it will continue on into the future. We had our Juneteenth celebration and brought the community out and had discussions about where we are, political discussions at the same time, celebrated with music and food and all of that. So we're very happy about our engagement with the community and giving them a platform that normally people don't have.
Well, Wendell, listen, I've been proud of you and the work you've done over the years, but this may be among the most proud I've been of what you've done. When I knew that you were involved in purchasing BLK and making sure that you preserved and helped that real treasure thrive. So congratulations.
Yeah. And more importantly, as you said earlier, we moved the station to Xavier University, historic Black college in New Orleans. And we are now working with the students there. So the students are able to influence programming. They're putting their programming together. They're going to be on and take over the station in the evenings. They're just coming back. They'll be coming back to school in a couple of months and start their programming. And they get a chance to work in the business side also with our general manager, Skylar Williams, and with our sales team, with our program manager, Gerard Stevens, and coming out with programming and in production, being able to go into the production studio and cut studios, commercials at the same time, learn the equipment with our producers. And so not only are we continuing a legacy, but we're handing that baton to a future generation as they train and become entrepreneurs themselves in business and in media.
Well, and as I mentioned, serving as I do as a member of the Board of Trustees at Xavier, I can tell you that's just been a tremendous asset for the students and for everyone at Xavier. We have questions that are popping up. And of course, people have been blowing up my cell phone with questions.
Okay.
So let's try to get to some of them. This is from someone who is a general counsel for one of our major clients at the company. As both an activist and capitalist, what do you think are effective activities for the community beyond voting and marching? What would you like to see happen with this Joshua generation?
Exercise your right of self-determination. Just politically, we always say, create the government that you want to see. I say that economically too. While we always reach out in food deserts, we reach out to different stores, please come, please open. This is opportunity. You're leaving so much finance and there's so much opportunity here. Create it yourselves, right? I tell that Joshua generation, the retail you wanna see in your business, you bring that in. It's your opportunity to create what you want to see. The two should happen concurrently, right? You address and make demands on your government, but at the same time, create what you want in your community. Exercise your right of self-determination. I say that all the time. The 20th century social justice movement was political activism. The 21st century social justice movement is economic development. I actually believe that I had a saying, and it's difficult now to even say, I don't know if it's still something that I may believe, but I could stop a bullet with a job. If people want opportunity and want access, and when denied that access and opportunity, those frustrations boil into violence. As a student of human behavior, as an actor, that is not absolving people of their responsibility. I'm not trying to place blame on anyone, but as a student of human behavior, let's not think that the violence that has become heightened in our communities, in our country, no matter what community you're in, is from the fact that people want access and opportunity, right? If they have access and opportunity and fail, it's almost a part of human nature to accept that. But to know that a sense of failure is happening because of a denial of access creates a frustration that I think evolves into bad choices and bad behavior. And so that's what I tell the community. And the other thing I say to the Joshua generation is there are those who do not have your best interest at heart. Dismiss them immediately as soon as you recognize them. That's what my parents taught me.
I know what you mean by that, but for people who might not, explain what you mean by that and give some examples of what you're talking about.
Anyone who says you can't do that, I dismiss. Yeah. People who you see purposely are putting obstacles in front of whatever you are trying to do, whatever endeavor you're trying to do, those, they do not have your best interest at heart. You see someone that kind of holds a prejudice against you, assuming you can't do it because of gender or race or social economic position you may have come from, dismiss them. I think we spend, my parents said, don't spend so much time trying to educate an idiot, right? Really, we spend so much time trying to appeal to the better nature of people, right? I say leave that to the artists, where we try to speak to hearts and minds. I say be dismissive of people as you're trying to execute your plans and moving forward. So, and you will know those who do not have your best interests at heart almost immediately, because can't, we had a saying in my family, can't die 3 days before the creation of the world. Don't ever tell me you can't do something.
I love that.
Yeah, we're country.
Listen, so you talked about the impact of the work and the messaging that artists can sort of bring to bear to these things. I had the privilege of seeing you perform in the title role of Death of a Salesman on stage in London. It was actually one of the last trips that I took before the pandemic, and you were fantastic, by the way.
Thank you. You
were nominated for the Olivier Award, which is the British version of the Tonys. The interesting thing about that, and a lot of people wrote about that in the press here and over in the UK, was it was very groundbreaking in that it was a classic play, Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, with an all-Black cast. And it was phenomenal. And I want you to tell me and the audience what that says about sort of the universal nature of some of the themes that were covered in that play and some of the themes that play out on a day-to-day basis.
Well, actually, it wasn't an all-Black cast. It was just the Lohman family. Right. So you saw the impact of the world around them, 1949, America, on the impact of this one Black family, African-American family at the time. The crushing betrayal that he feels, as I celebrate capitalism, that play was a chastisement of capitalism, how the individual can be lost for the sake of the corporate idea. And so it's a cautionary tale in that way that, you know, you could sell the American dream, but who is able to buy it? Who will be able to have it? It was actually a cautionary tale of what I'm talking about now, about there's so many people that feel as though only I am allowed to participate in that dream. But Death of a Salesman, the more specific you are, the more universal your themes become. A lot of people heard the play in a different light, and they actually thought we rewrote the play. And I said, no. We're just adding another element of drama, which is you understood the obstacles placed in front of this Black salesman in the 1940s America and those who practice a hypocrisy about those values. So all of the same sort of discomfort and disillusionment that Willie Loman finds in the play, to know that crushing element added with that, the prejudice of racism and how debilitating that is, it just adds fuel to the fire of what the themes are. When I say America is full of great people and wonderful towns, I can park my car anywhere in New England and cops will protect it like it's their own, right? And people see this image of this Black man saying that and going, oh man, his engagement with cops will probably not be as comfortable as he believes. And this disillusionment that he's in, and you see how not only can it be so crushing to the person, but how it destroys the family. And ultimately, we know from the beginning, he will lose his life because of this disillusionment. I'm very happy to say that the success of the play has now given us a new opportunity. We are going to be opening it on Broadway in September. I start rehearsals next month, and we'll be bringing it to the Hudson Theater on 44th Street in New York. So I invite everyone to come to New York this fall and see the production.
Well, as I said, I highly recommend it. I mean, you obviously have done a tremendous amount of work. I would be remiss if I didn't. I would not only be remiss, but I disappoint a lot of people in our audience if I didn't talk about The Wire. Mm-hmm. You might not remember this, Wendell, but before you left to go to Baltimore, you and I had dinner. It was me, you, Nadine was there. I think Lola Zeli, our mutual friend. And you were talking about this project you were going to be going to Baltimore to work on. And I had no clue at that time.
Right. Neither did I.
It would be. And I think you even said at first, the first pilot or so, you were like, what do we have here?
yeah, save your money, guys. We're going to be canceled, you know.
Exactly. Talk a little bit about The Wire and what that meant to you, to other members of the cast, and just more broadly to entertainment and to society.
It is the highlight of my career. It is the perfect example of the role of art in our society. You say entertainment, but entertainment is a byproduct of art. We are entertained, but the purpose of art is to reflect on what our conditions are as a community, as a society, what thoughts are to the individual, where you reflect on your triumphs, your failures, where you're going, where you hope to go. What those thoughts are to the individual when you toss and turn and reflect on your life, you know, in the middle of the night. Art is for the community as a whole, that place where we reflect on who we are, where we're going, what our triumphs are, what our failures are, what are our values, and hopefully in that forum of art, we are moved to act on those values. You have a Polish poet that moves the country to solidarity in Poland, like Wałęsa did. It is in that same vein that The Wire was this canary in the mine of showing you the dysfunction of a unique dysfunction of America that destroys the individual. And if we don't, do something about it, we're going to destroy ourselves, the whole of who we are. And that's the role that The Wire was. It was a cautionary tale. I had a line that just haunts me to this day, as I see what's happening around us. The bigger the lie, the more they believe, right? Yeah. In this world of, you know, of conspiracy and just outright mendacity, we have lost what authentic and truth is if we allow that to become the norm. And that's what The Wire was all about. You saw the effects of the American dysfunction if we allow the individual to be destroyed. And I am some of the best work that I've ever done. It will be the first line of my obituary. Some people say, does that disturb you? Someone asked me that yesterday. I said, no, it doesn't, because you would hope you mark your passing on the road just like you write it on a tree. Wendell Pierce was here. I did something. It's something that people are going to talk about years later. And in fact, we are celebrating the 20th anniversary of The Wire as we speak. Going around, and so many people are learning about it for the first time. We have a whole generation of parents sharing it with their kids, finally, who are now adults. And they're thinking that it has relevance today, thinking that it was written and done today, because we're still dealing with some of the same issues. I'm very proud of The Wire. And then it also introduced us to a repertory of great actors and writers, directors as well. We're all still friends today. And I would be remiss if I didn't say one of the greatest of that bunch was Michael K. Williams, who's a dear friend, and died a few months ago in September. And he was, you know, I think of his death, and it just magnifies the themes of The Wire even more. That in this brief time that we have, with all the talent that we have, it can be destroyed. And what we've created can be destroyed if we don't care for what we've created. And if we allow the dysfunction to continue, it ultimately will be destructive. And it's not a secret that Michael had his struggles, and ultimately that dysfunction destroyed him. And we look at all the talent that we lost in that destruction, of all the things that he was going to do. And I feel it's my responsibility to make sure that I do everything possible to mitigate that trajectory for anyone on a personal level. But then in our society as a whole, we have a responsibility to each other. Those themes have to be followed through. And that's what The Wire was all about. And it was also a visual novel that changed the way television is done.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I remember when I heard that Michael Kenneth had died, I texted you, and you texted me back, and you sent me, and you ended up posting this on Twitter, but you sent me a clip of an interview you were doing. It was like on the red carpet somewhere.
Right.
He was standing next to you, and you were talking about what a phenomenal person and actor he was, and the way he was looking at you, the respect and admiration was mutual.
Absolutely, man. He was the dearest friend. He's one of the most talented people around. And that's the role of an actor, is to, you know, we look and say, there by the grace of God go I. That's why we turn out the lights and go to the theater and look at a movie, not only to be entertained, but to understand that our impact that we can have on the community as a whole. And I think that's reflected in what The Wire is and the lessons that are still being learned today, the impact that it can have, understanding that the idea of this war on drug, how it was executed, was actually not in our best interest, that it's so destructive, not only to families and individuals, but to our society. And I actually tell businesses and businessmen and women, be selfish. Look at your bottom line and say, I can't allow all of this talent to be destroyed when I can be using it. It can be of some great significance to the vision that we're having and what we can do. And that's the thing that I hope that we get back to, is to understand, and this we talk about on WBOK all the time, that it's the community where you find your value and worth.
Well, so let me interrupt you. That actually, we only have about 4 minutes left. Mm-hmm. That actually is the question for you that I want to end with. And the reason is because, you know, there are a large number of corporate leaders joining us right now for this discussion. General counsels at companies, CEOs of companies, partners in large law firms. And, you know, I think we are in an era now where corporate social responsibility is starting to gain some traction. I think companies are required to have much more policy nimbleness than they used to have, the level of responsiveness that they need to have to stakeholders, both internally inside their organizations and external stakeholders, is greater than ever before. I think that accountability buffer between the leadership and the requirement of leadership in corporations to be responsive to their stakeholders is shrinking, but still there's work to be done. So what message would you give to leaders in the corporate space in terms of their responsibility, both to their own stakeholders within their organizations, but also to the general public and to society at large?
I would say to those CEOs and those corporate leaders who are on this to know that there is value in the very thing that people are asking you to consider. That these are, this is resources that can be used to increase your market value, to increase your relationship and value with all the stakeholders, that the very people that you we're asking you to branch out to and include in your mobilization moving forward are assets. You would never throw away your assets in your community, in your businesses. And so you can make demands of those who are making demands of you. Well, I want you to come to my company. I want to involve you in the company. I ask you to get your skill set up to a certain level because I'm going to need that. So it's mutually beneficial. It's mutually beneficial. And I want people to get out of the idea that you're doing it out of a need, out of a need to be approved of and being seen as being socially responsible. I ask people to go the other way. You understand what it's like to take resources and build on those resources. Look at your communities that we're asking for inclusion of as resources, as beneficial resources for you. It's a mutually beneficial thing. I tell people that our communities, that you're leaving so many talented people on the sidelines that can solve some of the issues that you have right now on your desk, on your desktop that you're dealing with, because the cure for cancer was already there. It was on some kid who never got out of high school, who never had an opportunity to go to Johns Hopkins and get into development. It was some young lady who was denied and told, don't go into science, that's not for you, because of a prejudice that women don't have the mental and intellectual facility to do that. It is in your best interest to do it. Exercise your right of self-determination. And as people are making demands on you, you can make demands on the skill set of people that you're bringing in, because people just want the opportunity. And you'll be surprised at the level of intelligence, of great work ethic, of productivity, that will be brought to your operation because of inclusion. It is an investment in yourself and in your enterprise. Do not see it only as a way of self-aggrandizement or self-congratulatory inclusion. I ask people to be selfish and look at your bottom line and understand that this is an asset that I'm bringing to the operation.
Inclusion, it is about the bottom line. That's a very cogent way to describe it. On behalf of everyone, thank you so much for joining us, for helping us to celebrate Juneteenth, and giving us some tremendous food for thought. You've carved out a lot of time. Just so people know, you're actually in Toronto right now working on a project.
Yes.
Tell us real quick about the project.
This project is called Accused. It's an anthology on Fox Television, where every week we're dealing with a different, they're dealing with a different story of someone who is accused, but there's always a twist to it. It's kind of like the Twilight Zone, but a thriller.
So when this comes out and you're watching it, you will know that Wendell Pierce took time out of that work to spend time with us and help us celebrate and focus on Juneteenth.
And just one other thing I want to say, you know, Juneteenth is a celebration for all Americans, right? It's a celebration for all Americans. It's the evolution of the best of us, a celebration that we evolved to a place, we took something ugly and made it beautiful. That's the lesson of Juneteenth. And to celebrate the resilience that we all share. And the more specific you are, the more universal you become. The more specific you are, the more universal you become. So you as a white male can look at this and still celebrate and say, Juneteenth is a part of my celebration as well.
Well said. Thank you, Wendell. And to everyone else, thank you for joining us. Thank you for making time. We appreciate you and have a good one.